The landscape of the Gospels is dotted with men and women coming into face-to-face encounters with Jesus. And every one of those face-to-face encounters is consequential. There is no such thing as a chance meeting with the Lord. And so those experiences are consequential. And every time Jesus engages with a person, they're impacted. Not in some lightning bolt fashion, but the trajectory of their lives change. It's a way that changes them forever. In other words, they are transformed. This is not a question about who Jesus is or how much head knowledge you have. How many of us realize lots of people know lots of things about Jesus? But there's a lot of difference between knowing lots of things and knowing Jesus. A world of difference, in fact. This is deeper than just knowing about Jesus. This is about your encounter with Jesus and my encounter with Jesus. Over the next three Sundays, we're going to look at some specific face-to-face encounters people had with Jesus. I just want to remind you of what I said, and that is that the landscape of the Gospels is dotted with people having encounters with Christ. I'm just going to lift out three over the next few weeks. We're going to look at an occasion where Jesus spoke with a Samaritan woman, a woman of questionable character. We're going to take a bird's eye view of an occasion when Jesus came into contact with a rich and powerful and influential man, Zacchaeus. But this morning, we look at a blind beggar. That's how Mark chapter 10 describes this. And what we want to do is we want to ask, what is there about this individual's encounter with Jesus that speaks to me? What is there that speaks to my life? And when we talk about a blind beggar, truth is, it may seem that there's not a whole lot. A blind beggar. But the best way to read the Bible, don't ever forget this, the best way to read the Bible is to put yourself into the passage. It's easy to stand back and read it from a distance, but when you see the Bible from the inside, you discover what God is saying to you out of that particular scripture. So I want us to do just that this morning. I want us to put ourselves in the place of a blind beggar and see what God might be saying to us. Now, let me try to set the context a little, because you realize that there are times when people take a text and rip it out of its context in the Bible. They'll take it and they'll rip it out and they'll have it mean whatever they want it to mean. But it's important not only to read the text, but to also know the context in which it is spoken. Jesus is passing through the town of Jericho. He's on his way to Jerusalem. Jerusalem to Jericho, Jericho to Jerusalem. It's about 17 miles from Jericho to Jerusalem. In fact, the very next thing the Bible talks about is Palm Sunday. What that means is that when this encounter took place, Jesus is less than a week from his own death. He'll be accused, he'll be tried, and he'll be executed. Now imagine that. If you knew that within a week you were going to be falsely accused, you were going to be tried, you were going to be put to death, I dare say your focus would be upon what's going to be happening to you. And doubtless, Jesus must have had some of that in his own mind. His eyes are on the road. He's making his way toward Jerusalem. And there are lots of people there. Jesus has garnered quite a crowd now. They're following him. But off to the side of the road, there is a person he doesn't initially see. I want to invite you to look with me this morning at this passage, verse by verse. And I want to ask you to look with me at what happened, and then I want to ask a specific question of relevance. First of all, I want you to notice in the very beginning of the passage, in verse 46, I want you to notice that this man was by the side of the road. He was off to the side. That's where he begged every day. It's also a way of saying that not only was he literally, but he was figuratively in life on the sideline, off to the side. It was like today when we see people begging, we have a tendency to want to look the other way. And so people did. This man wasn't in the day-to-day life mainstream. He wasn't a part of the day-to-day goings-on. He was off to the side, and that meant he was easily ignored. You know how sometimes you can go by something and see it so many times that you don't see it anymore? It can just become part of the landscape. That's kind of the image you need to have here. The man had become part of the landscape. So, my first question to you this morning is this. In what way might you feel that you are on the sideline? Maybe that has to do with work. At one time, you were respected. You were the go-to person. People really count. Your voice mattered a lot. But over the course of time, somehow that's been lost. Your services are no longer as important, shall we say, as they once were. It feels that over time you've just been kind of moved over to the side. Maybe it has to do with home. You're a stay-at-home mom. You're a mother, you're a cook, you're a cleaner of clothes and a chauffeur of children. You work very, very hard for all the other members of the family, but they only seem to notice you when they need something. Maybe that's you. Maybe even, God forbid, it has to do with the church. Maybe you come and you attend, but you really don't feel like you're part of what's going on. You really kind of feel like you're on the outside looking in, a spectator, if you will. Anyway, like Bartimaeus, you feel like you're on the sideline. Many people in life feel on the sideline, just on the outside. Many, many people experience that. They feel like they don't matter much anymore. So I'll ask the question again. In what way or in what area in your life right now might you feel on the sideline? And then notice in verse 47, he began to cry out. Did you hear that part of the scripture? He began to cry out. He wasn't satisfied just being on the sideline. He began to make himself known. Now, the truth is, there are a couple of ways people can cry out. You can complain, and you can accuse, and you can gripe, and you can say, I'm a victim, it's your fault, I'm a victim, I'm the victim, pay attention to me, it's someone's fault. It's my parents' fault. It's the government's fault. That's one way to cry out. From the standpoint of blaming somebody. You know, we live in a culture where it's very convenient to blame others, right? Because it's never our fault. It's always someone else's fault. But that's not what Bartimaeus did. He began to cry out genuinely for help. He called out to Jesus, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. He didn't cry out blaming other people. He didn't cry out blaming something. He cried out to the single source that can make a difference in his life. So my second question to you is, what is the cry of your heart? What is the cry of your heart? What's going on in your life right now? What might be going on in your life right now where you need a little guidance, need a little wisdom? It may have to do with relational healing, healing of a friendship with someone who's important to you. There was a problem, there was a misunderstanding, things got terribly bad and things have gone terribly wrong. It started out as a cut, but now it's a wound. And maybe you're just crying out, "Dear God, I've got to find a way to mend this." Or it may have to do with marriage, with your marriage. You got married, and there were such high hopes, but time has passed, and now all you're doing is trading insults with each other. It might be that you've reached a point where there was a time when it worked well. There was a time when things were great. But you're not there anymore. What is the cry of your heart? Could have to do with relational healing. Or it could be, as it is for many folks, a balance, a cry out for a balance between work and family. When I talk to people, what I hear almost as much as anything is, my life is out of balance. The things that I say matter the most to me are the things that get the least time. You know anybody like that? And what time I do have, I'm tired or I'm distracted. Maybe the cry of your heart is for balance in your life. Or perhaps it could be for physical healing. There's some physical infirmity you have or someone you love has, and your cry is for the dadgum pain to just stop hurting. I'm just hurting all the time. Maybe that's the cry of your heart. Maybe it has to do with mastery over some destructive habit. Again, the people at AA have known for years what the medical community has come to see, and that is that in many, many cases, only spiritual solutions work long term for people who are chemically addicted or have some other destructive addiction. What is the cry of your heart? Whatever the cry of your heart might be, the passage is telling us that it's okay, it's even necessary to call out to Jesus. Have you ever had a time when something brought you to your knees? You tried everything. You tried everything. And you're brought to your knees, and all you can do is cry out. Or there are some times when you can't even cry out. Have you ever been brought to your knees and all you could do was just weep? What is the cry of your heart? Psalm 124:8 says, "My help is in the name of the Lord." Sometimes we need to be reminded of that. And then in verse 48, I want you to notice in verses 48 and 49, there were voices of encouragement and there were voices of discouragement. Bartimaeus cries out, and there are voices of encouragement, voices of discouragement. There were some people who said, "Hush, hush, be quiet, shh. He doesn't have time for you. He's an important person, and he has important things to do, and by inference, you're not a very important person." So my question to you here is this. Where are the voices of discouragement in your life? It may very well be, as I think it is for most people, that your own feelings of inferiority and unworthiness. Maybe you are your own worst enemy. I find that more than having other people discourage me, very often it's my own feelings of unworthiness. And that's why the church needs to continue to say, God believes in you. You know, we say a lot, you need to believe in God. But we need to do a better job communicating, God believes in you. He's not finished with you yet. Where are the voices of discouragement in your life? Or it may be that there are some people out there who just don't believe in you. For whatever reason, they just don't have a whole lot of faith in you. They've been instrumental in sort of setting a low ceiling for your life. Where and what are the voices of discouragement for you? The time has come, and I say this to the people on via Facebook and other places, the time has come for you to identify the voices of discouragement and to begin to move away from them. Because if the rest of your life is going to be the best of your life, you've got to make some decisions about cleaning house of the voices that continue to hold you down. You can just rest assured there are always going to be voices that say you can't. Where are the voices of discouragement in your life? But Bartimaeus also had voices of encouragement, didn't he? There were others who said, get up! He's calling you, man, get up! Get up! He's calling you, he's calling you! Actually, what they said was, cheer up and get up. He's calling you. And that's ultimately what we must do. I was raised in Alabama, and we have a southern term. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. You familiar with the term waller? I know that's not. I know it's wallow, but in Alabama, we call it wallering. You know wallering? There are some people in this life who like to waller. They just like to waller in what's going on with them. What we have to do at some point is to move toward healing. Move away from the discouragement and move toward healing, because in the absence of something, something will take its place. If you try to get rid of the voices of discouragement in your life, and you do nothing, you just sit there and wallow in it, you won't get very far. But it's a matter of not only dealing with the voices of discouragement, but also moving toward healing and away from discouragement. So the other part of my question is, where is your cheering section? Where are those who encourage you and from whom you draw strength? They're there. You really, really are not alone. Where are the people? Where are the people who are the wind beneath your wings? I want to make a clear distinction here, though. And I want to be as clear as I can about this point. And I want you to be clear about this in your own life. People who love you and will challenge you in your life are not people who are trying to hold you back. They are, in fact, the ones who are trying to keep you between the ditches. The people very often that love you the most are going to call you out. And they're going to tell you, you've got to do this, this, you've got to do this. They're not your enemy. They're the ones who literally are keeping you between the ditches. And believe it or not, they're part of your cheering section. They're part of the ones who are holding you accountable. Don't ever confuse people who love you enough to tell you the truth with people who are holding you back. I'm going to say that one more time. Don't ever confuse people who love you enough to tell you the truth with people who are holding you back. They're not the same. So where are the voices of discouragement in your life, and where are the voices of encouragement in your life? Then notice in verse 50, it says, he threw off his cloak, got up, and went to Jesus. That cloak, you see, was a symbol that he was a beggar. It was like his uniform. His cloak was used where when people would drop money, they would drop the money on his cloak. They would drop the alms on his cloak so that he wouldn't go have to feeling around everywhere. The cloak was part of his uniform. He threw it off. And that's highly significant. He got rid of it. He got up and he went to Jesus. So here's my question to you. What is it that you need to throw off in order to move forward with life? You say, well, preacher, you've stopped preaching now and you've gone to meddling. What is it that you need to discard in order to move forward with life? Listen very carefully to what I'm about to tell you. I see way, way, way too many people who live their life looking over their shoulder at the past. Or they're carrying a load from the past that's just hanging on to them. What do you need to throw off in order to move forward? It may be a habit. It may be guilt, it may be anger, it may be resentment that you haven't let go of. It may be some hurt from the past, either present or long ago. But it is consuming you and it's held you back and you've marinated in it. It may be fear. It may be a relationship. You may be involved in an unhealthy, toxic relationship, and you're still wondering why things aren't going well for you. You get nothing else out of today's message. You get my next statement. Any relationship in your life is only going to be as strong as the one least committed to it. In order for you to move forward and be better and be the person God created you to be, what do you need to discard? And then notice in verse 51, Jesus and Bartimaeus come face to face, and Jesus says to him, what do you want me to do for you? I have always thought that was such a silly question. What do you mean, what do you want? Yeah. I mean, assuming when Bartimaeus got up and he began to move, let's assume he moved this way and Jesus was over here and somebody got him and moved him over this way so that they were face to face. And Jesus said to him, what do you want me to do for you? What a silly question. What do you mean? What do you want me to do for you? It occurs to me, though, that not everyone who is blind really wants to see again. There are some people who love being a victim. It gives their life some kind of special status. And to take that away from them, it is a mistake to assume everyone who's unhealthy wants to be healthy again. It is a mistake to assume that folks who are marinating in the mess of life want to get out of it. Have you ever known anyone that they complain and they complain and they complain and you try to get them help and they just aren't interested? Just not interested. And you want to pull your hair out. You want to say, I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to show you the... But it's like pushing a rope. It's a mistake to assume everybody who's unhealthy wants to heal. Jesus said to Bartimaeus, what do you want me to do for you? That's what makes it an important question. And Bartimaeus said, Lord, I want to see again. Which implies that there was a time when perhaps he could see. Something happened somewhere, but he says, I want to see again. Maybe there are some ways in which you've been blind. Maybe there's some ways in which you've had tunnel vision. And all that you're paying attention to is what's right in front of you. And there's this whole world going on around you. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asks. And all I can offer you this morning are the first words to the answer of that question. Here we go. You ready? Lord, please help me. And you fill in the blank. This message is meant to be personal today, because when Jesus encounters you, it's about you. I have people leave the church, walk out on Sunday morning sometimes, and they'll say, man, I sure wish my husband had been here. He needed that message. He really needed that. Or, I wish my child had been here. They really needed to hear that message today. This is not about them. This is about thee. This is about you. What do you want me to do for you? What do you want me to do for you? And then verse 52 says something amazing. It says, your faith has made you well. You know, there was a belief back in that time that people who were infirm because they had sinned. They'd done something to bring this on them, right? And Jesus says to Bartimaeus, your faith has made you well. Your belief in my power has made you well. Now let me say this another way. Jesus is saying to us, trust me with this. And if you will, I will begin to heal your life. Trust me with this. You know that old hymn we used to sing, All to Jesus I Surrender? You know that one? I think what Jesus says to us is, trust me with this, and I will begin to heal your life. I'm not going to work on your time schedule. I'm not going to be defined by your expectations, but if you will trust me with this, I will begin to heal your life. That makes this passage highly relevant to us. Because everybody in the room, on some level or another, needs to answer the question, what do you want me to do for you? Because that question is universal and it's timeless, isn't it? This morning, as we close our time together, we're going to offer you a time to come and pray at the altar. And I want to be very specific about this. I want to give you an opportunity to come to the altar and fill in this blank. Lord, please help me. And here's what's going to happen. You ready? You're going to want to pick it up and fix it again yourself. You know how we want to give things to God, and then if He's not doing it fast enough, we want to take care of it? I just want to remind you that Jesus still says to you, and He says to me, trust me with this. And if you will, I'll begin to heal it. You've tried it your way. Trust me with it.